This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory, which is a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Shai Dromi, who is the author of Above the Fray, The Red Cross, and The Making of the Humanitarian NGO Sector, which is out this year. And Shai is a lecturer in sociology at Harvard. So welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for having me.
No, absolute pleasure. And this is a great book. It's both a really interesting historical analysis of I guess an organization and a kind of phenomenon we take for granted every day, you know, sadly, whether it's on the news or, you know, giving to charity or whatever. But it's also a really, you know, kind of almost classic bit of what I'd call cultural sociology. And I'd like to kick off there, really, if you could tell me a little bit about what kind of cultural sociology is, what it is as a theoretical framework that you've used for this book.
Right. Well, first of all, thank you for the kind words about the book. The specific type of cultural sociology that I'm using in this book is usually referred to as the strong program in cultural sociology. It's a theoretical framework that emerged first in UCLA and then at Yale and moved to other places as well, which really emphasizes the effects of culture on various domains of social life, so politics, sports, academia, especially places that we wouldn't normally think of as being influenced by cultures. For example, the economy, where if you think about it, consumption patterns and types of economic decisions are absolutely variable based on national background, based on class background, and so on. So I'm drawing on cultural sociology in order to get a sense of how the type of organization that we know today as a humanitarian NGO, non-governmental organization, came to be so dominant, so taken for granted, really so pervasive in international arenas. And I'm conjoining it with a concept called field from Pierre Bourdieu's theory, which really looks at social domains where people pursue more or less the same activities and compete over dominance. So this would be academia, literature, government, sports, where the main question is how certain ideas about what, you know, qualities become valuable, how they emerge, how they help some people succeed and keep others back within specific bounded domains. And so both of these approaches together help me think of humanitarianism as a field that is, on the one hand, built of organizations that cooperate with each other. Think of, United Nations, various aid agencies, the International Committee of the Red Cross, organizations like Doctors Without Borders. But at the same time, they have some level of competition between them over what counts as a good humanitarian and how one might emulate the best form of emergency aid.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to get precisely into that struggle or contestation when we talk about comparing two organizations, which comes up a bit later in the book. I suppose the other maybe a bit of like ground clearing starting point is, you mentioned you've applied field theory and the Strong program to humanitarian work and, the particular story of one NGO. But I'm also interested in I guess what your sort of motivation or interest is in picking that particular empirical topic.
Yeah, I think the humanitarian sector really provides a really interesting contradiction, because on one hand, as like both of us said, humanitarian NGOs are everywhere. We hear constantly on the great work that Oxfam do and MSF. Other organizations internationally, they're getting a lot of funding from both UN agencies, but also individual donors. They're very well trusted internationally. And then on the other hand, both today and in, throughout history, there's been a lot of debate and questions about whether at the end of the day, having an outside volunteer donation-based organization come and intervene is actually the best solution for social problems, or is it possible that they're inadvertently causing long-term damage? And critics have pointed, for example, that these organizations are really not accountable to the populations they serve, unlike a government, right? That they are often uncoordinated, that they might inadvertently weaken existing local state institutions that might be able to help. So given on one hand this profound trust in organizations like NGOs, and on the other hand this critical debate, it struck me as interesting to find out how exactly this sector succeeded so well over the last 150 years, weathered many challenges, many internal splits, many outside criticisms. And this is especially important because if you look back, let's say 150 years ago to when the Red Cross started, there are many other ideas about what the best way to provide emergency aid are, including empowering states, improving states' capacities to deal with emergencies, promoting disarmament, reducing the actual harm that warfare causes, and so on and so forth. So the puzzle for me is how this one type of thinking about humanitarian aid really becomes so dominant to the level that it appears at least to be common sense.
Which beautifully preempts my next question, which is, well, how does it then? And the place to start, you've sort of alluded to in passing, is, I suppose it's, more 170 years ago, if we're thinking about the 1850s. And you have, I suppose, maybe two or three moments in the historical analysis. One is the reality of war at the time and how, war was conducted, how medicine was practiced. But then there's also, an individual story and in some ways a kind of a literary or cultural communication story as well. So it'd be good to think through the roots of the Red Cross, both in terms of, the kind of historical situation of war, but also the social cultural construction of how we might do humanitarian work that was developing at the time.
Yeah, I think that the story really starts in the 1850s. And that is not to say that humanitarian work didn't exist before, but the story of organized humanitarian aid, the way we think about it today, really started emerging then. So several things were going on at the time. First, there was a series of wars throughout Central Europe, the Italian independence wars, the German unification wars, and across Europe and to some extent in the United States, there was also new interest in battlefield medicine, with physicians, nurses, really grappling to try and improve medical aid to the wounded. Now, this is the context in which there are very inadequate medical care facilities on actual battlefields, both due to few working hands, lack of medical knowledge, lack of supplies. So we're talking about widespread gangrene, amputation is pretty much the basic response to a gunshot wound. And we're also talking about a great deal of disorganization within militaries around arranging supplies, sending supplies to the front. So at the end of the day, soldiers who were unlucky enough to be wounded at war often ended up being left to fend for themselves on the battlefield. If they were lucky, family members or friends would actually come and collect them from the battlefield. If not, they would often die simply due to lack of treatment. So that's on one hand. And then on the other hand, on the home front, there was an increased awareness of what was going on the battlefield, partially due to faster communication with the battlefield. So the telegraph was being introduced to battlefields. Photography was mobilized by reporters who then started publishing news much faster and with accompanying photographs. The Crimean War of the mid-1850s was particularly prominent in that regard, where Londoners suddenly found out that their relatives, their sons, husbands were dying in a very, very undignified way on the battlefield. And this of course created anxiety and has put pressure on governments. Now, in 1859, during the Battle of Solferino, part of the Second Italian War of Independence, incidentally, a young professional from Geneva called Henri Dunant was traveling to the battlefield to meet Napoleon III to try to promote his business. And he arrives there in the battlefield right after the conclusion of the battle. So what he witnesses is basically the aftermath, the people, soldiers from both sides of the battle wounded, many of them left basically without any sort of treatment, without water. And he's very moved. He and this is a relatively wealthy individual, relatively resourceful. And he manages to arrange help both locally, call out to local church organizations, local villagers to come and help, but also to send to Geneva to ask them to send supplies. And he writes a book in 1862 on his experience, basically reconstructing both the experience on the in the battlefield in the local hospitals, what he saw there. And then also he writes a short proposal that how much things could have been better if there would be an aid society that's just available, that's just waiting for the next battle to occur in every major city in Europe. And then rather than being left on the battlefield, people couldn't count on someone coming and picking them up. Now this book comes out, and it certainly wasn't the first report from the battlefield. People already knew, as I said, about the situation. But at the same time, the book did several things very successfully. It both dramatized successfully a whole set of concerns that people had about the battlefield. So both the senselessness of the battlefield, of the deaths, every family liked to at least hope that if their relatives die in the battle, they would die in some sort of a dignified manner. Instead, Dunant was showing how undignified the deaths were. People were dying without their last rites, in extreme pain. He also exposed the inefficiency of the existing medical aid on the battlefield, showed how basically there were no working hands, very little medical knowledge, causing great bane. So that was one. A second thing the book achieved was really providing a specific kind of recipe, right? How can we succeed in alleviating their pain and actually demonstrating it through his own actions, through Dunant's own activism in the battlefield and in the surrounding hospitals, in particular in treating both sides equally. So both sides of the battle were treated as equals when it came to being taken to the hospital. And third, and no less important, that Dunant managed to circulate the book very widely in social networks. So he was a very resourceful person. He printed it out of his own at his own expense, sent it to aristocrats all over the country, all over the continent. It was translated. Aristocrats read it. Monarchs read it. He traveled in person over 1862 to talk about the book. Received by Queen of Prussia, among others. And the important thing organizationally is that it got the attention of his colleagues in Geneva, especially a jurist called Gustave Moynier, who was moved enough to start thinking together with Dunant about ways to realize these proposals. Now, over 1862, there were several unsuccessful attempts. Dunant and Moynier tried to arrange various conferences to promote this idea. And finally, they succeeded in arranging an international conference to convince delegates of various countries to support the establishment of societies that would be volunteer-based, and they would be really oriented just to helping the wounded in war in an impartial manner. And those became the proto-humanitarian organizations that we know today.
I mean, it's really interesting because the book lays out, I suppose, a series of alternative past and futures where, you know, it's not necessary that we have volunteer organizations that are, you know, treating both sides equally and are essentially sort of almost accepting the idea that wars are going on. You know, we could have seen interventions that were much more robust in you know, calling for like peace, disarmament, you know, kind of what we think of now as like anti-war movements, but, you know, maybe isn't appropriate to give them that label.
Yeah,
at the time. And it, you know, the story you tell is, you know, of almost, you know, a kind of ironic success in terms of, you know, a later Nobel Prize, but also a slightly kind of sad and lonely death despite his campaigning work. Now, one of the things that is particularly interesting is the role of Christianity here. Because, you know, he was associated with the YMCA, although, you know, part of his the tragedy of his life was being dismissed from working with the YMCA.
Yeah.
And different varieties of Christianity having almost kind of different takes on how to deal with some of the problems that are laid out in his book. And the role of Christianity, you know, whether it's as radical anti-war with the Quakers or, you know, a more traditional, I suppose, you know, kind of palatable to state Christian response of things like, you know, the importance of charity and humanitarian. I think are particularly fascinating. And I guess that's the next stage in the story, isn't it, really? That the role of Christianity that takes the Red Cross beyond one man's campaigning and makes, you know, the foundation of both an organization but also an international network.
Yeah. So as you say, I mean, the idea of having volunteers do this work was not natural at all, not taken for granted. And as you say, some of Dunant's contemporaries, especially Quakers, but also, you know, pacifists, socialist pacifists, were not convinced, right? And were in fact saying, this is not a good thing. You're going to help states battle wars by taking away their responsibility to take care of anyone, because you're going to have volunteers do that work, right? So instead, they were saying we should be supporting disarmament, we should be supporting world peace. But Dunant was coming from a very specific tradition within Christianity. So he was coming, first of all, from Geneva, which back then was hardly the, you know, human rights mecca that we know today. It was very well known for its theological institutions, especially as the historical home of Calvin and one of the more important centers of the Swiss Reformation. And earlier in the century, earlier in the 19th century, there was a very serious revival in Reformed Protestant parishes in the city of Geneva, especially with younger pastors looking to reinvigorate Reformed Protestantism and faith and worship through a movement called the Réveil, the Awakening, with the idea that Christianity should not be just confined to sermons and Sunday and just some general abstract set of values, but it should actually permeate all of social life, politics, charity, everything regarding the polity. And this movement was international. It struck roots in the Netherlands, parts of what would become Germany later on, parts of France. It was international. It was very influential. Now, particularly important was that pastors in this tradition were critical of the idea that wars can actually be eradicated, right? So very much against this idea that progress can just erase warfare from human experience. And in a way, this was a more pessimistic view than the various pacifist movements around. Pessimistic in the sense that the ideas of wars are just almost inevitable, that we should always be prepared for the next war. And second, they were also critical of the idea that the state should be in charge of welfare, and instead thought that, you know, Christian charity was the way to solve public problems. So ranging from poverty, alcoholism, and also, you know, on a larger scale, wounded soldiers requiring help and so on. Now, the figures we talked about, Henri Dunant, Gustave Monnier, their colleagues, they were born in the 20s, so in the 1820s. So they grew up in the 30s, 40s, and learned with some of these faith leaders, attended their sermons, attended some of their churches, got some level of theological education, and at the same time, they were wealthy enough to actually try to think of social initiatives that would follow up on these ideas in Geneva. So you mentioned the YMCA, but Dunant and one of his physician colleagues were also members of an organization called the Committee for the Wounded of the Evangelical Society of Geneva, which was very much doing Red Cross type work already in the 50s. Moinier, who I mentioned, and Theodore Monoir, one of his another doctor colleague, were members of the Geneva Society for Public Welfare. Again, a society just interested in doing grassroots charity organizing, and very much not relying on the state to do anything in terms of welfare. Now, Moinier quickly becomes the dominant figure in promoting the project of the Red Cross. And he and his colleagues were indeed pushing ideas about humanitarianism that kind of reflected their theological understandings. So given that wars were not going to end anytime soon, they were advocating for permanent aid societies rather than just maybe bolstering some of the military medical facilities. They were very adamant that these aid societies needs to be independent from the state, not working within the state's approval, of course, but not reliant on the state, not reliant on the logic of the state, not subservient to the military, and that they should be working universally, internationally, caring for all those in need impartially. So much of their work in the 1860s really had a Christian Reformed Protestant core to them that they were pushing through this work of establishing a humanitarian sector.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I mean, but particularly interestingly, it's not what I might think of as a sort of, you know, universalist project, because at the same time, the Red Cross is, as you show sort of through the middle of the book, it's quite patriotic, it's quite nationalistic, which, you know, on the one hand might seem like a contradiction, but and I know, you know, cultural sociology is wary of the term ideology, but, you know, it's using the kind of the key ideological framework that, you know, is crucial to understanding nation formation and European history at the time. And I think that is maybe the other pillar that, you know, you've got on the one hand this particularly strong Christian set of principles, especially around charity, which becomes important later on in the story too. But also, you know, it's an expression of national consciousness as much as it is a kind of cross-European universalist project.
Yeah. Yeah, so funnily enough, this was really not a kind of cosmopolitan boundary defying project, right? This was the Red Cross and much of the accompanying, you know, donor base, volunteer base, and so on, were very much nationally organized, and were often envisioning the Red Cross as a curious conglomeration of, on one hand, the an international spirit, you know, some sort of sense that they're working for humanity, but at the same time, very much a patriotic pride and an extension of, let's say, national moral virtues. So, for example, both Prussia and France had Red Cross societies established already in the 1860s. In 1870, 1871, they go to war with each other. During the war, both of their Red Cross societies become very active, become very involved in taking care of the wounded, in trying to prevent hospitals from being attacked, and so on. And then during the war, each Red Cross society also envisions itself as more and more national, as more and more reflecting the respective nation's kind of moral character. So right after the war, Prussia starts brandishing in France's face, you know, the great humanitarian efforts that they have, their wonderful Red Cross society, and actually accusing France of not being, you know, not following the spirit of the Red Cross project, and that they weren't, you know, they were not impartial. They were not impartial. They did not respect the neutrality of Prussia and hospitals and so on. And we see this again and again in various different contexts, right, where the Red Cross becomes somewhat of a symbol of each country's unique qualities. We're also seeing national figures, you know, so Joan of Arc, for example, in France, Colombia, the personification of the United States in the American Red Cross, kind of come and you know, be very much used in posters, flyers, and so on to represent the Red Cross Society of that specific country. Another interesting thing that we're seeing is actually emerging nations of the time. So let's say Serbia, Bulgaria in the 1870s. one of the first thing they do as they gain independence is establish a Red Cross Society that's specifically Serbian or Bulgarian, or even Hungary, which was still part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, insisted of having a Hungarian-speaking Red Cross society in Budapest. So having a Red Cross society also signified for many countries the an independence, membership in the family of nations, and so on. And this was particularly important in the Far East. So for Japan and for Siam, having a Red Cross society was also an assertion of you know, equality with the West, or even surpassing the West. Incidentally, Japan, with their Red Cross society, outdid their Western counterparts on almost all fronts. And became well known both for their efficiency, but also for the unusual humanity they exhibited toward wounded foreign nationals, particularly Russians, right? They would be enemies. And this was, of course, then used in Japanese propaganda as well as a feature of Japan's mercifulness, humanity, as well as their military superiority. And I'll just mention that as a side effect, within several countries, there was also domestic competition between various competitors on which society is the most Red Cross society. So in England and in Hungary, there were several different groups claiming that they are the official Red Cross societies, and the other are copycat Red Cross societies for a while. And because this was with the understanding that being the Red Cross, being humanitarian, being the National Red Cross Society is also a source of prestige, a source of kind of represent a way of representing the nation, a way of appealing to national governments, national leadership, and so on.
I might ask you to sort of pick up on that point and bring us closer to a more contemporary setting. I mean, there's so much more we could talk about in terms of the development. I mean, you know, we've got the gender politics of the Red Cross, its relationships to things like nursing, charity, journalism, international law, all of which are in the book. And, you know, again, as with all of my podcasts, you know, I really urge listeners to read the book. But that sense of, you know, competing institutions looking for the official status, I think takes on a new form in you know, comparatively contemporary settings when we see the rise of what you talk about as new humanitarianism, but you give the specific example of MSF, you know, Medicine Sans Frontières, as having a very different seemingly approach to the Red Cross, but also being indebted to some of the logics that you've already sketched out.
Yeah. So really the 1970s saw an enormous split in the international humanitarian community with the organization Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, emerging first in France and then several other national chapters. And challenging the Red Cross and saying, you know, we need to rethink how we're thinking about what being a good humanitarian is. And I think this was particularly around the issues of neutrality and impartiality, because at least the International Committee of the Red Cross historically interpreted its you know, main role as being the aid provider who avoids conflict and treats whoever they can safely reach. So, for example, in World War II, it came under a great deal of criticism that they did not publicly speak out about Auschwitz and about everything that was going on in Germany. And later on, their line of defense was, well, we needed to maintain access to the prisoners of war that we did have access to. So had we spoken out about what we knew, we would have lost access to millions and millions of aid recipients who needed our help without any assurance that this would actually make a difference in terms of the concentration camps. Doctors Without Borders came with pretty much the opposite approach. So this organization emerged in the 70s in France. It was established by doctors who worked actually for the French Red Cross and were very frustrated with the Red Cross's policies. And their interpretation of what it means to be a good humanitarian and to be impartial is actually to speak out as an impartial witness when witnessing infringements of international humanitarian law, state negligence, human rights abuses, and the likes. And that this is what the best form of humanitarianism is. Now, they were established in 71, and within several years, they learned that they actually need to be much more cautious because in several occasions, when they did speak out about what they saw, they were also expelled from the sites where they worked by the local governments who did not want these witnesses just hanging around. But the interesting thing is that I think, as I show in the book in detail, there really is no split with the Red Cross's ideals about what role humanitarians play in the world, right? That they should be neutral, that they should be independent, that they should be impartial in whatever way you interpret that. In fact, the opposite. The question becomes who best emulates those Red Cross ideals that, you know, have been in existence for a century back then, and who does them best. So there's an interesting continuity between the thinking of Dunant, Moynier, and the thinking of those figures who founded Daughters Without Borders 100 years later.
Now, usually I ask, so what are you working on next to my authors? But given that the book is like literally hot off the press, it was published, I guess, you know, third week in January of 2020. I think a more interesting question, and this picks up directly on the continuities you've sketched out between MSF and Red Cross, it is a question about what do you think cultural sociology sort of offers, I guess, our contemporary humanitarian NGOs and, you know, people making policy, maybe people, you know, seeing the Red Cross adverts on television, this... absolutely brilliant academic analysis that, you know, shows us the continuities and the changes over time. What are you kind of hoping the impact of it might be on our contemporary world?
I think there are two main takeaways for humanitarian organizations, their supporters that we should really consider. So one, I think the book shows that religion has served a public good historically in creating this sector, in shaping it, in mobilizing populations to join it. But existing literature has also shown that many humanitarian organizations do not work with faith-based organizations, and or at the very least treat them with great suspicion that they might not really be impartial, or they might have some underlying motive to evangelize and so on. When, you know, in fact, in many parts of the world, religious organizations are the first responders. So Puerto Rico, after Hurricane Maria a couple of years ago, had a massive failure of some of the national aid organizations, but at the same time, local churches were the ones who were both able to provide the help in real time and to actually form connections to mainland United States and bring supplies from there. So I think in contrast, sometimes when you look at press releases, mission statements, and so on of existing organizations and interviews with some of their officers, we're seeing religion treated as primarily a cause for conflict. So part of one of the issues that the aid organization should address, rather than a source of good. So keeping in mind that aid organizations often serve communities that are deeply religious themselves. One of the takeaways here is that we should really reconsider how we think about religion in the humanitarian community, and that maybe drawing such severe lines between self-described secular aid organization and faith-based aid organization is not necessarily the best policy. I think a second kind of more general takeaway is that the book shows that the way we think today about addressing humanitarian emergencies is really one out of several ideas that have been around historically. And we've talked about peacemaking before. Actually, peacemaking is one of the harder causes to raise funds for compared to humanitarian aid, to emergency humanitarian aid, where I think the book shows that in many ways there were other ways that the history of humanitarian aid could have gone. And I think understanding that, you know, volunteer-based, donation-based NGOs are just one option, and we should consider positively, things like human rights interventions early on, civil society organization intervention in peacemaking early on could actually be viable either alternatives or at least complementaries to the way we conduct humanitarianism today. So these are the two main takeaways, I think, the cultural sociology in this book can offer.